WPFW, Washington.
The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. One should, for example, be able to see that things are hopeless and yet be determined to make them otherwise. F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Dialogue.
Good evening, America. Welcome to Dialogue. I am your host, Mark Levine. I used to work as an attorney in Congress. While I worked there, I saw all kinds of information that the mainstream press, I should call them a mainstream mess because they are a mess sometimes, but the mainstream press was not reporting. And so I decided to come on the air and give you the inside scoop. On Dialogue, on TRWPFW, we're going to be talking this week and next week about the four recent Supreme Court decisions. I am also a constitutional scholar. I have a degree from Yale, and on my show, The Inside Scoop, we talk about the Constitution all the time. I'm glad to talk about it with you here. Four main decisions, very important, by the Supreme Court last week. The most important for the city of Washington, D.C., of course, is the overturning of the D.C. handgun ban. The Supreme Court ruled that the Second Amendment, which talks a lot about militias, suddenly doesn't apply to militias anymore, and now your gangbanger can get his gun. That may not affect a number of people across the country. It certainly affects the people in D.C. But there are three other decisions that I definitely want to talk about because they're also important. One is the declaring unconstitutional the Millionaires Amendment. We're going to go into some detail on that, but basically what the court said is that a rich person in America has more rights to free speech than a poor person, that it is unfair. It is unfair and unconstitutional to allow someone who is poor to have the same rights to speak as someone who's rich. The rich person must be allowed a greater opportunity to seek political office and to speak out. We'll talk about that. There were two other decisions, and these came down on what we might call the liberal side. One said that people cannot be held in jail in Guantanamo Bay indefinitely without charges, that people should have a right to show that they're actually innocent rather than be held in jail for life. You would think that this was an obvious decision, but it, like the others, was a 5-4 one-vote decision. And lastly, there was a decision by the Supreme Court that a child rapist should not be executed with the death penalty, that the death penalty should be reserved for people who murder people who are intend to murder people. And if you want to call in, this is Dialogue, so I'm always glad to hear from you. The number is 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. What's interesting about all four of these decisions is they were decided by the barest of majorities, by one vote. They were all 5-4 decisions. And eight of the nine justices, they voted the same way on all four decisions. Four conservatives on one side and four moderates on the other. You really can't call the Justice Souter and Stevens liberal. I mean, they were appointed by Republicans, Stevens by Ford and Souter by George Bush Sr., but they joined with the two moderate Clinton justices, Breyer and Ginsburg, consistently. And then we have the four right-wing extremists. Scalia and Thomas were right-wing long before now. After all, they appointed George W. Bush president, even though the voters of the United States and of Florida chose Al Gore. But they've been joined by the two Bush justices, Alito and Roberts, and have also formed a consistent block. The swing vote in all four cases was Judge Kennedy. And Judge Kennedy voted to overturn the D.C. gun ban, to make sure that millionaires have more free speech rights than poor people. But then he voted to actually allow people in Guantanamo Bay to challenge their detentions and also to prevent the execution of a child rapist. So if you want to talk on any of these topics, I want to hear from you, 202-588-0893. Let's start with the D.C. gun ban because this one most affects the city. And the thing I think you'll find consistently true about all four decisions is that if the people in trouble are poor and non-white, well, the Supreme Court really doesn't care about them, right? I mean, if you're looking at the victims of D.C. gun violence, or if you're looking at people trying to run for office who don't have millions of dollars, well, the court really doesn't care about them very much. And the conservatives certainly don't care about non-white people in Guantanamo Bay just sort of taken and thrown in for life, nor about the person accused of the child rape. But what's interesting about all these decisions is that if you ever thought the conservatives were not judicial activists, well, obviously you'd be wrong. You find all four cases, you have the Supreme Court overturning a law passed by states, passed by the District of Columbia, passed by Congress, and in all four cases. And perhaps in the D.C. case, you find the most activist judges of all. I am not one that believes that handguns should be banned across the United States. I think if you live in Montana or West Virginia or Tennessee and you want to have a handgun and you live out in the wilderness and you've got to worry about coyotes or bears or, frankly, you would like to enjoy hunting, that makes sense. And that state and that locality could vote to allow you to have a gun. As long as you haven't committed a felony or a crime of violence, go at it. I don't know many liberals, in fact, that want to ban all guns in America. I certainly don't. I just want to register them, and people want to go hunting, that's fine. But the District of Columbia is not rural West Virginia. It's not rural Montana. The D.C., of course, used to be the murder capital of the United States. It's still very, very high, one of the highest in the country. And you don't see many wild deer, bear, or coyotes in the District of Columbia. Yeah, there may be a few rats, but I don't know that you need a gun to deal with them. So what was the Supreme Court doing? Well, they looked at the Second Amendment, and they basically ignored the whole first part of the amendment. The Second Amendment says, a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, what does that mean? Well, the founders were very worried about a standing army. You see it in their writings all the time. They were very worried about a strong national government basically interfering with the rights of the states and the people of the states. You know, I mean, after all, they just had a king of England that had gone in there and tried to make all the states conform to his will. So they knew that well-regulated militias, people in sort of states' armies, could protect themselves against a tyrannical state with their muskets. And that militia being necessary, that well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, meant that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. In other words, it made a lot of sense for its time. Doesn't make so much sense today. Now, that doesn't mean, as Scalia argued, that the amendment is extinct. Certainly, people have a right to join up in well-regulated militias today. Certainly, that's a right that people in the District of Columbia and throughout the United States enjoy. But it doesn't mean that everyone can go out and have a grenade launcher. The problem is that Scalia seems to throw out the entire preamble to that amendment. He doesn't seem to care that it talks about militias and says, you don't need to be in a militia. You can own anything you want. Well, if you take out that clause about the militia and you just ignore it and you pretend like it doesn't exist, then it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, I could tell you that it's a collective right. It's the right of people, not persons. It's the right of people joining together to protect their neighborhoods. Maybe a neighborhood watch group or the guardian angels if it were well regulated by the state. But it's not a personal right. I could tell you that, and I could tell you that keep and bear arms really means, well, what do? You bear arms in the military. You don't bear arms in your home. You might carry a weapon to defend yourself. That's what we say, carry a weapon. But when you bear arms, that's for a military. I mean, when's the last time you ever heard somebody say, I'm bearing my arm? No, that's a military term. Okay, but if you take it all out of context, as the court did by a 5-4 decision, and you say that what it really means is that everyone has an individual right to have weapons, well, then there's no limit. I mean, the court seems to say, well, there can be a limit. You can prevent felons. You can prevent mentally ill people. You can. Not from this amendment. If you ignore the whole militia part of this amendment, it says that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. If you say that the people means individuals, and you say bearing arms means carrying weapons, well, that means that everyone can have their own grenade launcher. Everyone can carry anthrax. Everyone can have a nuclear suitcase. Well, that's like a terrorist bill of rights. What is the purpose of the people who want to make sure that residents of the District of Columbia don't have to have trigger locks on their guns. Someone, I mean, explain this to me. There's a guy in Georgetown, there's an article in the Washington Post, and there's Gillian St. Lawrence of Georgetown. And he said, this is a direct quote, "I'm thrilled that after being involved in this case for 6 years, I'm finally going to be able to take the trigger lock off my shotgun and load it if I need to be able to defend myself in my own home." Really? Because if some intruder was in his own home, does anyone think he would be so worried about the law that he wouldn't undo his trigger lock? Does that mean that if you're being chased by an attacker, as Stevens argues in the dissent, you're not going to jaywalk because it's against the law? Of course you're going to jaywalk, and no police officer would ever give you a ticket for jaywalking running from an attacker, just like no one would ever prosecute you for taking the trigger lock off your gun in your home if there actually were an intruder there. But what if there weren't an intruder? What if you heard a noise and you didn't have a trigger lock and you shot first and asked questions later and you killed your own child or your spouse or your mother or your friend who came in and the door was unlocked? The fascinating thing about having a gun in your home is how rarely it's actually used to stop intruders. It's interesting. There was a study in Atlanta of 197 home intruders. Now, Atlanta is a city where one-third of everybody owns a gun. And the study showed that 1.5% of the time, 3 times out of 200, did somebody actually use a gun to prevent the intruder. More than twice as much, the gun was used against themselves. And if you go outside the home context and you just look at guns in general, there's a fascinating statistic in America. Do you know how guns were used in America to kill people? 51% of gun murders were suicide. 44% were murder. Of gun deaths, I should say. 51% suicides, 44% murder, 3% were accidents, 1% were in self-defense. Of gun wounding, same difference. 1% in self-defense. In fact, the study showed that if you have a gun in your home, you are 12 times more likely to have someone in your home killed with it or wounded with it than killing or wounding a bad guy. I want you to think about that statistic. 12 times more likely. You know, in the game of Russian roulette, you take a six-shooter, right, and you put one bullet in it, and you pull the handle, and you got a 1 in 6 chance of killing yourself and a 5 in 6 chance of living. And most people think it's a pretty stupid game. Well, if you have a gun in your home, it's like taking two guns and loading them with 11 bullets. One gun has all bullets in the 6 shooter, and the other one has got 5 out of 6. And then you pull the trigger. Most guns in the home are never used, but when they are used, they are 12 times more likely to kill you or your family than to kill a bad guy. It's like playing reverse Russian roulette with two guns. And yet the United States Supreme Court, anxious to protect all those gun nuts out there, I guess in Montana, I don't know if there are many in D.C., maybe you'll let me know, decided that D.C. can't ban handguns. Now again, I'm not saying that people in Montana who hunt and fish can't have their guns. In fact, I would think that if you got a rifle or a shotgun, you'd be more likely to have a steady hand in hunting than with a handgun. I mean, what is states' rights all about? It's about allowing the people of Montana to have as many guns as they want, or Texas or Tennessee, but allowing people in urban areas to protect themselves. That's what conservatives used to look out for. Not anymore. For 20 years, the Second Amendment has been understood to only apply to militias, but now we have a court where it applies to everyone. And one justice decided it. Think about that. We've got a call on the line. It is Bernest. I hope I pronounced your name right. Bernest, welcome.
How you doing?
Doing good.
Yeah, I was going to comment specifically on what you were saying before about the police not having any problem with people breaking the law, mild laws or what have you, in order to safeguard themselves. You were giving examples like jaywalking or taking the lock off your gun to somebody's in your house. I've heard personally of at least two examples when I was in Virginia where a person had his license registered weapon, kept it in his, you know, nightstand and had his ammunition for it in another part of the room, and somebody broke into their houses and he went and loaded the weapon and went down and slew them. And they had gotten indicted for, I think it was involuntary manslaughter, both of them, two separate cases, like 2 months apart.
Bernice, I tell you what, I want to see those cases. Because I honestly, I think, I just, I don't,
that
doesn't sound right. Because
no,
I don't think it's right. I mean, you know, I went to law school. I know the rule. If you've got someone, a burglar who breaks into your home, you have a right to shoot them.
What you're supposed to do is call the police.
Well, I agree.
And then the police ask you, can you leave? And then they want you to go ahead and leave the house and leave law enforcement to the police when they show up.
And I think that's the better option.
And that's what they want you to do.
I think that's the better option because the police know how to handle it a lot better than you do. You're going to be scared out of your mind, even if you've had gun training, and most people haven't. You know, you're not going to want to get into a battle, particularly if you've got a wife and children in your home. But notwithstanding all of that, the law is that if someone breaks into your home, and that's the language you used, and you have a gun, you have a right to shoot them. But you might not agree with that law. But I'm, particularly in Virginia, I'm really surprised. So I want to ask you a favor. My email address, it's mark, M-A-R-K, at radioinsidescoop.com. Send me those cases. Because I want to see what you're talking about, and I'll
Radio Inside Scoop.
Yeah, and I'll report it on my blog, and I'm going to be here next week at WPFW, next Tuesday at 7, and I'll report back the findings. I promise you, I'll look it up, and if you're right, I will admit it on the air. How's that?
That's fine.
All right, no, because I want to look at it. I'm a little skeptical, but I will look at your evidence. I promise, and I'll be here next week to talk about it. All right.
In addition to that,
yeah,
there's a subject you haven't gotten to yet. With regard to wealthier people having the
right, I was just going to get there, but go ahead.
Freedom of speech than people who are non-wealthy.
Right.
As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Alexander Hamilton and others during their Continental Congresses were saying that the government should pretty much be run by the wealthy anyway, because they have a greater stake in the future, and they pretty much, you know, care about, you know, with the wherewithal and the legacy of the nation, while the poor people just kind of go day to day, and that it shouldn't be a situation where it's truly one man, one vote, because what do poor people care or know about the day-to-day management of government?
Well, Bert, you're right about Alexander Hamilton. He definitely looked out for the wealthy, and you're also right that at the beginning of our country, only, you know, wealthy white men who owned property could vote. But ever since, you know, Jefferson and then Jackson and then further on, then all white men with property could vote, and then, of course, later all men and all women. But you're absolutely right about Alexander Hamilton, but I don't think that I mean, what's interesting about this case, and it actually gives me a great segue. Thank you, Bernice, for your call. What's interesting about this case is how, when you look at it, it just doesn't make sense. Let me go through. Let me explain what's going on here, because a lot of people haven't followed this very clearly. Bernice has, and I appreciate his call. The case is the Millionaire's Amendment. Now, what is that? Congress passed a public financing bill. John McCain, in fact, supported it. He's backing off a bit now. But the idea is this. If you have two candidates running against each other, and they both have about equal wealth, then what do? They try to get supporters. We know that, for example, Barack Obama got 1.5 million people to give him some money. Half of the money that Obama's gotten is under $25, okay? Half of the money that's been sent to him. So he's not really in the pocket of anybody. He's getting a lot of money from low donors. That's how he's financing his campaign. But let's say you've got a guy who has no support, but he's got a lot of money. I mean, it doesn't even have to be a conservative. I can look at, you know, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. I don't know how many millions, probably billions he has, but here's a man who can finance his own campaign. He doesn't need to raise money from poor people or middle-class people or even upper-middle-class people. So what the Supreme Court was saying, and this goes back to a case in 1976, is that you can't restrict someone paying their own money to promote their campaign. And that was the law in 76. So in other words, if you've got one person that has a million supporters, each of them giving him $25, and you've got another candidate who has no supporters, he has nobody who agrees with him, but he has $100 million, then he gets four times the speech of the guy that has a million supporters. So a guy with a million supporters gets one-fourth the speech of the guy with no supporters but $100 million. Now, Congress decided that that didn't make sense. They felt that it's unfair that if you have two candidates and one's much wealthier than the other, that the other candidate's speech gets drowned out by the louder, more powerful, richer candidate. So they passed what's called the Millionaire's Amendment. And what this amendment does is it says that if you spend more than $350,000 of your own money, and there's regulations for spouses and things like that, but basically if you spend your own cash, $350,000 of your own cash, then your opponent, who hasn't spent his own cash to that extent, in other words, you spent more than $350,000 more than your opponent in a congressional race, your opponent can raise money in greater limits. That's a little confusing. Let me explain. When you give a political candidate money, there's a limit. You can give up to $2,300, and that's to prevent people from, buying members of Congress. Well, that's the general limit, but if you got millions of dollars, you could just spend your own money. Well, the idea is if you got a multimillionaire spending millions of his own dollars, then the poorer candidate can actually increase that maximum three times to $6,900 and use that increased maximum to raise more money to get a more equal chance at speech. Now, it doesn't prohibit the rich guy from speaking. It doesn't prohibit the rich guy from spending $1 billion on all the ads in the world to speak. All it does is it allows the contrary point of view to be financed as well. Well, the Supreme Court was very upset with this. Judge Alito said that it's absolutely unfair. It is absolutely discriminatory to say that a poor man should have anywhere close to the amount of speech a rich man does. A rich man has an absolute right to be heard greater than any poor man. That's what he said. Because he said that you can't help an opponent speak more. He said that was an infringement on the rich guy's speech. Now, I want to think about how silly this is, right? I mean, I'm a firm believer in free speech. I'm a firm believer that Nazis and racists can march and speak, and they have a right to do so. And the way you deal with hate speech and terrible speech and speech you disagree with is you have your own rally. You got five people in white robes teaching hate. You bring out 50,000 people in a counter rally teaching love. You fight speech with speech. And that's the best way to do it. Well, the Supreme Court is saying that if the five people each have $1 million and the 50,000 people have $1, then those five people get 100 times the speech of the poor people. And that it's illegal and unconstitutional for Congress to decide to allow the poor person to also be heard. It's an amazing ruling. Because the ruling, the amendment didn't stop the rich guy from speaking. All it did was allow the non-self-financing candidate a chance to also be heard. So, Congress passes a law to try to stop the perception that congressional seats are out for sale to the highest bidder. And the Supreme Court holds absolutely not. You have a right to buy a congressional seat. We won't even let you raise money if you're the poorer candidate to try to stop the difference. And of course, it was actually a really well-drafted law, because if the poorer candidate were to make up the difference, well, then it would all be, they'd all be equal. They wouldn't get the limits anymore. So this is one of those things that I think that the public doesn't follow very closely. And yet it's very, very important to the government, because you shouldn't be able to buy influence. And if you've got a multimillionaire who has the free speech right to spend millions and millions of dollars on him or herself, then you should be allowed to raise more money. Again, not spend more money, but at least raise money. Let the voters make the choice. So the irony is that here you had a guy, a Jack Davis, who spent millions of dollars losing a congressional seat. And he was arguing it was unfair to him. It was unfair to him to allow a poor candidate to raise more money so that he could get close to where Jack Davis had spent. You know, Jack Davis spends $100 million, say, and the poor candidate spends $1 million, and because of this law, he can raise $3 million. And they said, it's unfair to him. I deserve 100 times the press of the poorer guy. An amazing decision, and one in which, well, let's face it, the four conservatives joined with Anthony Kennedy to decide. Now, Kennedy did go a different way on the two other decisions. And both of these, all four of these decisions, show the power of this swing justice and the real importance of the election coming up. Because, let's face it, the four right-wing conservatives are quite young. And the four less conservative are quite old. Justice Stevens is 88 years old. Now, I wish him a long, long life. But it's, you know, quite possible, quite likely, in fact, that Justice Stevens will not live eight more years into, you know, the next presidency. If we have an Obama presidency, then he'll replace Stevens, and the court won't get any more liberal. It'll probably just stay the same. Indeed, if Obama's elected, probably the court won't change much at all. It'll still be very conservative. Remember, Anthony Kennedy chose Bush to be president, even though the people didn't choose him in 2000. But if McCain is elected and Justice Stevens is replaced by just one conservative, then even this moderate conservative Kennedy will be out. If John McCain becomes president, then the four right-wing extremist majority can do everything. There's no question that Roe v. Wade is out the window. There's no question that poor people will lose any right to challenge anything. I mean, you know about the recent Valdez decision, too. I haven't even gone into that one. That was the oil spill out in Alaska. And there you have a ruling that you can't punish an oil company for allowing a drunk guy to drive a tanker that led to the greatest oil spill in American history, where the people who suffered the oil spill, Alaskan fishermen, and they get paid about $10,000 or $15,000. Now, the jury didn't want that. The jury wanted each of them to be paid about $100,000. But no, you can't punish the largest corporation in America. You can't punish the richest corporation in the world, ExxonMobil. These are friends of the Bushes. That's already the Supreme Court now. Where could the Supreme Court go with John McCain? Well, think about the two decisions where Anthony Kennedy came down on the less conservative side. One, I've talked about repeatedly on the show, that is on Guantanamo Bay. He upheld the old right of habeas corpus. What is that? That means that if a prisoner is put in jail, he has a right to say, why? Why'd you put me here? If we grab, as we did recently, a Chinese guy who escaped persecution in China and grabbed him in Afghanistan and put him in Guantanamo Bay, he has a right to say, hey, why am I here? And it turns out it's all based on secret evidence with no reliability provided by the Chinese government. Well, then he has a right to be freed. That right, that basic right we all have, not to be thrown in jail without being told why, would go by the wayside. 202-588-0893, Joe, welcome to Dialogue.
Hey, how you doing today?
Doing good.
Good, good. I was listening to your show, and it's very interesting. And, you know, I don't know, I don't want to sound like a pessimist, but, I mean, I expected nothing else, and I'm trying to figure out, I guess you're trying to rally the people who are listening to your voice, but, you know, I think that we all understand in 2000 when the Supreme Court elected George Bush, or selected George Bush, I should say, I mean, that was a death knell. I mean, and at that time, I heard nothing from anyone. Journalists, individuals, here was a Supreme Court that had actually overruled a state's decision, which was up to that point predominantly nothing but the state's determination regarding voting.
You're absolutely right, Joe. Let me tell you something. That's how I got my start in radio. That's why I came to D.C. I was hired by the Congressional Black Caucus to challenge the Florida electors. So there are many, many people who felt like you did, who felt like I did. You're right. The mainstream media didn't focus on it. That's exactly why I'm on the air. That's why I'm at WPFW. That's why I do my own radio show. I appreciate your call very much. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more dialogue right after this message.
Freedom is a road seldom traveled by the multitude.
Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it.
Hi, this is Gladys L. Brooks, producer and host of From the Vault from the Community.
And this is Bobby Hill, WPFW Program Director.
Please join us on Friday, July 4th, as we present an all-day special entitled Freedom of Speech Day, a grassroots alternative holiday commemoration.
On this day, from 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., WPFW will be airing rare speeches and programs from Pacifica and WPFW's rich archives. Please tune in to hear the voices of folks such as
Harry Belafonte,
Arundhati Roy,
Isabel Allende,
Sabina Virgo,
James Baldwin,
Sam Cooke, and others.
Again, that's Friday, July 4th from 9 a.m. until 6 p.m. as we present an all-day special entitled Freedom of Speech Day, a grassroots alternative holiday commemoration.
On WPFW, your station for jazz and justice radio, serving the collective needs and imagination of the community.
Hope you got the deck, baby.
Welcome back to Dialogue. I'm your host, Mark Levine. The phone number is 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. The last Supreme Court decision, although you're welcome to call in and talk about any of them, frankly, the last one, and one that really, I think, is not as much about the Constitution as it is about where your heart is, where your mind is. And that's about the case of the convicted child rapist in Louisiana. Now, it's a pretty awful and disgusting set of facts. The man is accused and was convicted of raping his stepdaughter, aged 8. Without getting graphic, there was tremendous violence, tremendous damage. And he accused a couple young boys in the community. He, by the way, still insists to this day that he is innocent. And the girl originally said it was the boys and then later said it was her stepdad. Now, you know, I don't know whether the man is innocent or guilty. I do respect jury verdicts most of the time. And so they saw the evidence. I didn't. The question is not whether the man should be free. The question is whether he should be kept in jail for life without parole or whether he should be executed. And I should just say there was no DNA found. Now, you know, the girl was washed. He may very well be guilty, but it's not, you know, absolutely 100% certain. But at the end of the day, the Supreme Court had to come down and make a decision on the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, and had to decide whether or not someone who commits this awful, awful crime, but didn't intend to murder the girl, and didn't murder the girl, whether he should be executed. And the court pointed out that no one has been executed for a crime that did not involve murder since 1964. So we got almost 50 years, almost a half century of states throughout the United States saying only murder is the crime, and usually multiple murder, and particularly vicious first-degree murder, is the crime that's worthy of execution. I thought there were a lot of good points made by the court. Children are perhaps more, well, not perhaps, are certainly more easily manipulated than other witnesses to crimes. I mean, those of you that have been through some tough divorces know that very unfortunately, many times, parents put their children in the middle and tell them to say things, sometimes even in a court of law, about their father or their mother that are not true or are exaggerated. And it's an awful, awful thing. And sometimes it leads to child custody going to the wrong parent. But imagine where a false accusation could lead to someone's death. The other point I think is made most often by child advocates for why it's not a good idea to execute child rapists is that for a child rapist, after having done what he's done, and obviously the criminals are overwhelmingly male, but after committing rape, the rapist, if he knows he's going to get the death penalty, he should probably kill his victim. I mean, he has no incentive not to, right? The Supreme Court ruling today gives an incentive for the rapist, as awful as he is, to allow the child to live. To say that, you know what, I don't want to die, so I will allow the child to live. It's pretty important. The important thing, though, for all these four Supreme Court decisions is noting how small the margin. 5-4. And the justices aren't even talking to each other. I mean, I read through these opinions. I heard, usually it was Justice Stevens, the eldest of the justices, standing up for the liberal point of view. 88-year-old. I wish him well. And then there's, of course, Justice Scalia, mocking and angry. And really just plain illogical. I mean, here's a justice who, let's face it, is going to twist the law whatever way he can to do what he wants to do with it. Yeah, I want to tell you about a conversation I have with Justice Scalia, and I'll get to that. But first, it is dialogue, 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. Rose, welcome to dialogue. Rose, are you there? You're on the air.
Thank you very much. It's like a law seminar.
That's what I'm giving you, see, for free. You don't even have to pay for law school.
It's brilliant. Thank you. I had just a constitutional question.
Go for it.
We have remedies for errant presidents, unless you have Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi. You're able to impeach a president. Is there a remedy for justices, and what are the precedents for that, and what are the politics of that? Thank you.
Great question. Impeachment does not just apply to the President of the United States. You can impeach a justice of the Supreme Court. Indeed, one of the earliest impeachment trials in American history was 1804, when the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Salmon Chase, was impeached. He was later acquitted by the Senate. But yes, the impeachment clause makes very clear that the House and the Senate can impeach and remove from office the President of the United States, the Vice President, judges, and all officers of the United States. For example, I used to argue back when Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez was there that they needed to impeach him, and they could have impeached him. Now, when you impeach the president, then the justices, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, rules over it. But he wouldn't rule over it if it was his own impeachment. But yes, Antonin Scalia could be impeached. I have to say this, though. You're only supposed to impeach a president or vice president or officer of the Supreme Court for high crimes and misdemeanors. And, I am certain, there's no question that George Bush and Dick Cheney have committed high crimes and misdemeanors. I mean, you could just go through the Constitution. They tortured in violation of the Eighth Amendment. They spied on people in violation of the Fourth Amendment. They put people in jail without access to a lawyer in violation of the Sixth Amendment. They violated free speech in honor of the First Amendment and religion, First Amendment. I mean, you just go through each and every point. They stopped habeas corpus. Clearly, and not, that doesn't even get into lying about the war and the war crimes, violation of Geneva Conventions. George Bush and Dick Cheney, who has committed treason by outing a CIA agent, have committed high crimes and misdemeanors. Scalia? I don't know. Don't get me wrong. I detest Justice Scalia's rulings. I think they are illogical. I think he pretends to be a strict constructionist when actually he doesn't give a damn about the text of the law. He's actually just trying to put in his point of view. The only thing that comes close to a high crime would be the 2000 Bush v. Gore decision, because there you had a decision where the American people and the people of Florida voted for a man for president of the United States, voted for the electors, the electoral college that would vote for him. And that's true in Florida, too, by the way. It's one of those small, barely reported stories, in fact, that when they finally did count the votes in Florida, which wasn't until April of 2001, they found that no matter how you calculate it, no matter whether you count chads or don't count chads or one corner or two corner or however, whatever standard you choose, Al Gore got more votes than George Bush in Florida. That's one of those little reported stories. Even Matt Drudge reported it. Conservative right-wing Matt Drudge. If you don't believe me, Google it on the internet. You'll see the original site. The point is that Justice Scalia stopped the counting of votes. Now, I remember when Milosevic in Yugoslavia, in Serbia, had an election, and he stopped the counting of votes because he was losing. And the people of Serbia rose up and they burned down the parliament. In the Ukraine, when they stopped the count, they had the Orange Revolution. The people filled the streets and they forced them to count it accurately. When Scalia stopped the count in Florida, a few people clucked, a few people's tongues wagged. Al Gore decided it was best for the nation just to concede. I think he was wrong about that. I think he would agree that he was wrong about that now. I don't think he ever imagined we would have the lawlessness of the president that we have. That's the one thing that Scalia's done that I think might well rise to a high crime and misdemeanor. The rest of the things he's done have been just things that I fervently and strongly disagree with him. And I do not believe, and if you know, you disagree, call in. I don't believe that just because I disagree with someone on how to interpret the law, that that's enough to impeach someone. I want to see some kind of corruption. But choosing the President of the United States in violation of the Constitution when the American people choose somebody else, you might be right, Rose. That may be a worthy ground for impeachment. I want to tell you about a conversation I had with Justice Scalia. I've talked about it frequently on my show. It may be news to you. But it's fascinating to me that Justice Scalia claims to be a literalist. He claims to take every word in the Constitution literally, to be a strict constructionist, as he calls it. And he calls the liberals judicial activists. And conservatives suggest all the time that conservatives follow the law while liberals are making up the law. Actually, it's the opposite. If you look at the case of the Bill of Rights, the law prohibits torture, but the president did it. The law prohibits throwing people in jail without a lawyer, but the president did it. The law prohibits sending people to secret prisons and torturing them, but the president did it. The Fourth Amendment clearly says we have a right to a warrant. You have to have probable cause to believe someone's committed a crime before you can spy on our phone calls and our internet. But the president did it. So conservatives really don't believe in following the law. If liberals do, and frankly libertarians do as well. It's not just liberals. But Justice Scalia, when I was at Yale Law School, came before a group of students to argue his judicial philosophy. And I will give him this little bit of credit. Justice Scalia likes a good debate. He likes a good battle of wits. And he's certainly a very intelligent man. And at least he, unlike, say, Rehnquist, was willing to come before a bunch of students and defend his views. And I remember that the issue of the Second Amendment came up in that very debate. Now, we were a bunch of law students. One of the advantages of being a law student rather than being a lawyer is that you can talk kind of rough to a justice. I don't mean rudely. But I do mean you could express your opinion. I mean, if I were a lawyer, and I used to be a trial lawyer, if I were a lawyer appearing before the United States Supreme Court, I'd have to treat them with respect, and I couldn't be quite as tough in my rhetoric because, hey, I don't want my client to lose the case. But when you're a law student, you can say anything you want. So Justice Scalia is up there, and he's talking about each of the parts of the law that he supposedly takes literally. And someone from the room says, well, what about the Second Amendment? I mean, what if someone wants to have a nuclear warhead in their home? You're telling me that you take the Constitution literally, and you're telling me you have the right to bear arms? How could you prohibit that? And he said, gave kind of a smirk. And he took out his pocket Constitution. He's flipping through it, just as I'm flipping through my pocket Constitution as I speak. And he said, let's see what the law says. It says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. We'll just ignore that point. Go ahead. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Bear arms. What does it mean to bear arms? Scalia asked. Bear means to carry. Can you carry a gun? You can. Can you carry a nuclear warhead? No, it's too heavy. Next question. Everybody in the room laughed. This was a guy who said that he truly is taking the Constitution literally. So I asked him about another decision, one that he had just ruled on at that time. It's famously called the Peyote decision. It's a decision that said that Native Americans could not practice the culture they practiced for thousands of years using a hallucinogenic drug, peyote, in religious ceremonies. Now, again, Native Americans have been using this drug for thousands of years before any non-Native Americans came to these shores. And you would think that the First Amendment, which says, you know, Congress cannot prohibit the free exercise of religion, would respect their religious tradition. Scalia said no. He said that as long as the neutral principle is observed, in other words, as long as the government is not trying to ban your religion, but just passing a law, in this case an anti-drug law, if the government's passing a law for a neutral purpose, an anti-drug law, and you want to use the drug in violation of, because it's your religion, tough noogies. You've got to stop. Well, I'd be the first to agree that there's some religious practices we can't allow. I mean, I'm sure there are ancient tribes who threw virgins into pits, right? We can't allow religious murder. Fine. But I also think we have to allow some religious accommodation, and I don't think that when Scalia says it's a neutral principle, it's always okay to overrule a religious teaching, that that's right. So I decided to talk to Justice Scalia about his own religion, Catholicism, to hit him where it counts, so to speak. And I asked him about civil rights laws. I said civil rights laws ban discrimination on the basis of sex, on the basis of gender. Now, currently, those laws exempt religious institutions. But what if Congress were to pass a law that said that religious institutions couldn't discriminate on the basis of sex? That's a neutral principle. It's not designed to affect religion. But based on that neutral principle, of course, the Catholic Church would have to accept women priests in the United States, right? Scalia said, well, Title VII, the civil rights law, has an exemption for religion. I said, I know it does, but what if it didn't? What if it were a neutral principle and it said you can't have any discrimination on the basis of religion and you can't have any discrimination on the basis of gender? Well, you have argued that, you know, just like the drug laws, religion has to bow to the neutral law, right? Women priests, not unconstitutional, right? Well, we were in front of a group of people, and Justice Scalia backed down. He said to me, I'll get back to you on that one. We didn't have email address in those days. I gave him my phone number. I gave him my address. He never got back to me. Wonder why. The reason is that for Scalia, all these neutral principles that he talks about are big, fat hypocrisies. For Scalia, he cares about drug laws. He doesn't care about Native American religious practices. So in that case, the drug laws trump religion. But in the case of the Catholic Church, which he loves, and in the case of civil rights laws, which I guess he has less respect for than drug laws, the Catholic Church wins. I think that we can argue for strict literalism, for strict constructionism, and it's not a conservative thing and it's not a liberal thing. I am proud to be a Constitution-bearing liberal Democrat. I'm okay with this document as it currently exists. You know, I mean, I might want to change a couple things, but this document has come a long way from 3/5 of a person in its original draft, not allowing women equal rights in its original draft, or African Americans, or it had a lot of problems in its original draft. But with the amendments, this is a document that's changed over time, that's become better. It's our secular religion. It's the only thing that all Americans can agree on. And I'd like to see more liberals come out and say, I just want people to follow the law. I believe in the law. I believe in the Constitution. I believe our president should be held to a higher standard. And the callers are right. Because we haven't held our president to a higher standard, because we haven't insisted on the rule of law with him, with Cheney, with Scalia, then conservatives get away with the argument where they say, well, liberals don't care about the rule of law. We do. We just don't have the power to enforce them. Dialogue number again, 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. What do you think about the D.C. gun ban? What do you think about gun laws in general? Do you think it's a good idea? Because in the case of the gun ban, of course, there's two separate questions. One is the constitutionality of the idea, and the other is whether it's a good idea at all to say that you shouldn't be having handguns. Now, I know from those that prosecute these crimes that it's a lot easier if you simply ban all handguns. Then the police know if someone's got a handgun, they're up to no good. And again, I think this only makes sense in an urban environment. I understand why D.C. passed the law it did. I don't think it would make sense in Texas or Tennessee or Montana. But we have a real problem on the streets of D.C. We have people killing people, and it's happening all the time. And let's face it, most of the victims are poor, most of the victims are black, most of the perpetrators are poor, most of the perpetrators are black, and the United States Supreme Court isn't focusing on them now, is it? When the Guantanamo Bay decision came down, the habeas corpus decision, Justice Scalia, when he found out in dissent that actually the court was going to uphold this ancient right of habeas corpus, was going to allow people to challenge their detainment in a court of law, well, he had a hissy fit. He said, the nation will rue the day. Americans will die, he said, will die. Not because these prisoners are freed, and they're not being freed, but simply because they'd have their day in court. On the Guantanamo Bay decision, Scalia was basically saying he doesn't trust the American system. He doesn't trust jury trials. He doesn't trust our system of justice. Now, he trusted it completely when it came to the child rapist, right? He's more than willing to execute him. But when it came to people in Guantanamo Bay that are being held not for anything they've done, but because someone somewhere thinks they may have done something wrong, but is unwilling to prove it in a court of law, Justice Scalia, well, he isn't interested in the American system of justice. He doesn't believe in our system of justice. He doesn't think it can work. Now, I am more than willing to believe that some of the people held in Guantanamo Bay are terrible people. I am more than willing to believe that many of them are terrorists. I am more than willing to believe that some of them have done some very evil deeds. But I also believe many of them are innocent, swept up on the battlefield, like this man from China who just recently was found by a court of appeals to basically be escaping Chinese oppression in Afghanistan and picked up on the battlefield. Scalia says, uh-oh, if we allow these detainees a chance to get out of jail, if we allow people a chance to prove their innocence rather than keeping them in jail for life as a protective mechanism, people's lives will be in danger. But when it comes to guns in D.C., when it comes to the fact that you're 12 times more likely to die from a gun in your home, you or a family member, than shooting an intruder, Scalia doesn't care. When it comes to gang warfare in the streets, when it comes to drug laws that ensure that there is this contraband going around, the drugs that people are using and, you know, cause a little harm, lend themselves now to great gun battles that cause a lot of harm, Scalia doesn't care about that. And you know what? It's a lot more people. As awful as September 11th was, 3,000 innocent people dead, we have tens of thousands killed by guns every single year. And the government of the District of Columbia decided to do something about it. Elected by the people to do something about it. Scalia doesn't care about them, does he? Whatever happened to states' rights? Whatever happened to allowing the people's representatives to choose what they want? Numbers 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. Now, I know there's some gun nuts out there. There always are some. You can call in and tell me why you love your guns. But I'm curious for the gun nuts out there, if you really think you need a handgun in D.C. I mean, let's say you're trying to prevent an intruder from coming in your house. You can pick up a shotgun, even one with a trigger lock, and scare the person away. Frankly, it's a lot scarier when someone's got a big rifle pointing at you than somebody with a shaky hand and a handgun. They happen to be a lot steadier. D.C., by the way, did not ban all weapons. It banned handguns, and it said that rifles and shotguns have to have trigger locks. Emin is on the line. Emin, welcome to Dialogue. Did I pronounce your name right?
Yes, Iman. Yes, sir.
Iman, okay. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on, sir. You hit it right on the head. Justice Scalia, his son, incidentally, teaches at my alma mater at the University of Virginia College at Wise. And I recently had a conversation with him concerning the recent decision. And surprisingly, he was disappointed in the decision. It's just sad how these justices, particularly Scalia, does not take into account the egregious gun fines that occurred, especially considering what just recently happened with Ronnie White. I think this is just really going to perpetuate a lot of anger held by blacks and gun violence, and that's just going to increase with black-on-black crime, but I also think that they were going to get into a little scuffle with police officers, and it's just going to be a mess. So I just wanted to make that statement. Thank you so much for your contribution. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Let me just ask you before you go. You talked to Scalia's son. Scalia's son disagrees with the D.C. gun decision by the Supreme Court?
Yes.
He disagrees with his father?
Yes.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm surprised and pleased. Thank you for that. You know, I don't think it was the same son, but there was another son by Justice Scalia that actually represented George Bush in the Bush v. Gore decision. And I called at that time for Scalia to recuse himself rather than hear an argument from the firm that employed his very son. Had he done that, had he recused himself, had he not heard the Bush v. Gore decision, the decision would have been 4-4, the Florida Supreme Court would have been upheld, the votes would have been counted, and Al Gore would be our president today. Think about that. And we wouldn't have two other right-wing Supreme Court justices like Roberts and Alito on hand. You know, it's interesting to me what Iman had to say, because we do have a major problem in D.C. And I don't want to say it's only the conservatives. I might surprise you with how I'm going to end this today. I certainly think it is a problem with conservatives. I do think Scalia doesn't care about poor black people. I also think that you've got rampant guns in there and you've got terrible drug laws. But I also know that the government doesn't provide enough resources to prosecutors, to police, to go after these crimes. And there are also problems with D.C. juries. And this is how I'm going to end, and it may surprise you. And if you disagree and we run out of time, you can come get me next week. I'll be here again Tuesday at 7 p.m. But I have a problem when juries see that someone has committed a crime of violence, see that someone has committed a vicious crime of murder, and let the person go because they don't want another, as some say, poor black man in jail. I have extreme sympathy for the victims of violent crimes. I don't have much sympathy for the murderers. I really don't. I know some of them are from broken families. I know some of them have had, you know, terrible lives. I understand that. But that's no excuse in my view. And if you allow a murderer to go free because you don't want to see another poor black man in prison, then that murderer will likely kill another victim. And so I ask on behalf of victims everywhere, if you're on a jury, weigh the evidence. If he's not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, you let him go. Absolutely. That's our system. That's how it works. But if you're convinced that someone is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, particularly of a violent crime, don't think about the perpetrator. Think about the victim. And think about if the victim were a member of your family. We have to convict real criminals out there. So this is a problem that doesn't just affect conservatives, but also affects liberals, too. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you want to find out more, you can email me. Just send an email to Levine_Mark@WPFW.org or Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. My show is on RadioInsideScoop.com, and I hope you'll check it out. Let me know what you think of today's show. I'll see you next week. If you've been percolating some of these ideas, we're going to go on some more about these Supreme Court decisions. And if you disagree with me, I want to hear from you. That's what dialogue's all about. This is Mark Levine signing off.
A conversation in which we all get a chance to speak, to listen, to be heard, and to collaborate to solve our problems. Participatory democracy is not just insider talk about or among winners.
WPFW, Washington.